The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
All of us have healing work to do on race and culture topics. We have those questions that seem to be unaskable in today's climate. Now, we have a forum where we can ask experts, listen, and share. Welcome to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. Get ready to engage and add your voice to racial healing in the next hour. Let's start right now. Here's Sharon E. Davis.
Well, welcome to our show today, and it is a safe place to talk about race. I'm delighted that you've taken time out of your day to join us. You know, if you have a question, you can call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 866-472-5788. And you can also send us an email at info@safeplaceonrace.com. Well, we do have another very exciting show for you today. And as always, we like to share that racism is not our fault. We were born into part of this story, but we don't always know the other stories of members of our human family, and we're in the process of digging our way out of this ditch. The Saints of the 60s did their job. And yeah, we erroneously learned our way in, and we will intentionally learn our way out. Part of the show today is about finding out answers and information that can help us all. Well, I am delighted also to welcome Mr. Tim Wise, who is an anti-racist author and educator. And you may know that he is one of the most prominent anti-racist writers and educators in the United States. And he's been referred to as one of the most brilliant, articulate, and courageous critics of white privilege in the nation. And he also is referred to as a 25 visionaries who are changing your world. Welcome to the show, Tim. Hi.
Hi, Sharon. How are you?
I'm good. Good. And yourself?
Doing okay.
Well, Tim, there are so many things that we could start with and talk about. Today's show theme centers around possibly a new demonizing trend and what happens when government programs for social services or human services are suddenly needed by more white people today. And has demonizing those who use services now bleed into a new quote-unquote colorblind hue? And what are white people supposedly doing in terms of the blame finger? Is it in a new direction, far, far away from race? And, you know, this show isn't exclusively about European Americans. It's about the topic for today's session. Well, what do you think about this topic as a whole, a new demonizing trend?
Well, you know, there's a lot there to unpack. I try to unpack as much of it as I can in Dear White America, which is my latest book, and I've talked about these concepts for quite a few years. I mean, the point that I'm trying to make in that book is that there's sort of an irony to the current economic crisis, and not to dismiss the very real suffering of millions of white men and women and white families, but the irony is that the very kinds of situations that millions of white folks are now finding themselves in, housing foreclosures, long-term unemployment, a very inadequate safety net from, you know, inadequate unemployment insurance to inadequate food and nutritional programs to inadequate housing programs and public education funding, all of that is stuff that people of color have, of course, dealt with generation in and generation out. And in fact, for the last 40 years, as the white right in this country has demonized those social safety net programs, really demonized the whole concept of the public sector and the public good, and have tried to link in the white voter imagination those programs with black and brown folks as a way to demonize them, as a way to scapegoat those for the country's economic problems or whatever else. What we now find ourselves 40 years, you know, after that process began, is you've got millions of white folks who also need those kinds of social programs, those kinds of safety nets, but they have been eviscerated. They have been cut. They are currently, again, on the chopping block on the part of an awful lot of politicians, right at a time when millions of white folks suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, we probably need those programs for us as well. So the economic insecurity that has plagued black and brown folk for generations is now coming back on white folks, and the irony is that so many of those white folks have for two and three generations now voted for candidates who actually did all they could to eliminate those programs. And so here we are, you know, with millions of folks in the same boat and not realizing the role that racial scapegoating and really racial resentment and even racism played in cutting the legs off the table, so to speak.
Well, you know, as always, Tim, when you articulate these messages, they seem to form a very vivid, vivid picture. And maybe before we go a little further, maybe we can find out a little bit more about you and what motivates you and keeps you going on this subject that you've been really dealing with, writing about, working tirelessly for so many years on. What keeps you going?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not really, I guess, all that interesting an answer. I mean, the truth is that, you know, people of color have been fighting the issues of racism and institutional white supremacy for hundreds of years. And I think as a, you know, middle-aged white man in the 21st century United States, which is to say that being white, being male, and being a U.S. American, I've sort of, you know, in terms of privilege, power, position, opportunity, and access, I've somewhat hit the lottery of life, frankly. And I don't think I have much right to complain about how difficult it is to, you know, fight for social justice when other folks who have had an awful lot more to lose than I have been doing it. So what keeps me going is both the recognition of the history of these brave men and women of color and white allies in whose footsteps I try to walk, and knowing how much harder it was really for them and how much more they've gone through, how much more they've sacrificed than I will have to. Also, you know, being a parent and looking forward to a future in this country that I think unless we figure out a way to engage in ally building and solidarity across racial and ethnic lines, we are going to probably not survive as a country and maybe not as a planet. And I don't mean to overstate it or engage in, you know, excess hyperbole. I quite seriously mean that I think unless white supremacy, institutional white supremacy on a local, national, and even global scale is not dealt with and dealt with forcefully and, frankly, diminished if not eradicated, we're going to have a very difficult time surviving as a productive society in our own country, in the United States, in 35 years when people of color are half the population, half are white. We're not going to be able to be a productive society if we get to that point and half of the population, which will be people of color, are still, you know, twice as likely to be out of work, three times as likely to be poor, 1/20th the net worth, double the rate of infant mortality, 9 years less life expectancy. I mean, that's not a recipe for a healthy society for anyone, including my white children, and if I have them one day, grandchildren. So really, it's as much about preserving a society that, as critical as I am of it, I dearly love, and the people in it whom I dearly love. And I think this inequality is really not a good bargain for anyone in the long run, even though, you know, those in privileged groups in the short run benefit from it.
Well, you know, Tim, I think that your answer has so many multifacets to it, one of which, of course, is the future, not only the future of our society and our country for that matter, but it seems like it's gotten personal with you, you know, that not only is it about that kind of future, but future for your children and grandchildren as well.
Right.
When did it get really personal? Did that happen, Tim?
You know, for me, I mean, I think like a lot of white folks in particular, our, you know, introduction to these concepts of oppression and injustice are sometimes, you know, rather academic compared mm-hmm. to the way people of color experience them, which is much more lived. That's not to say that there aren't an awful lot of poor and struggling white folks who actually do have an experience of economic oppression. But I grew up like most white Americans, which is to say that even though my family didn't have a whole lot, we certainly weren't oppressed or marginalized. So my introduction to it would have been somewhat academic, but, you know, going to college where I did in New Orleans, Louisiana, and after graduating from college, working as a community organizer in mostly income, low-income communities of color there, mostly black communities in public housing, really getting to meet the people who were every single day against great odds trying to raise their families, trying to put food on the table, trying to go to work, or if they didn't have a job, find some way to keep it together in spite of, you know, economic and racial odds being completely stacked against them. And it was unbelievably inspiring. It was very personal because the people I met were, to be perfectly honest, some of the, you know, most wisdom-filled people that I'd ever met, even though their formal education wasn't all that impressive, I suppose, even though most people in this country, I suppose, wouldn't give them a whole lot of credit for being particularly quote-unquote smart. But whatever book smarts they may or may not have had, they were incredibly wise people. And what was jarring to me about that was that, you know, I, like most folks, no matter how liberal or progressive our political views, had still been led to believe that, you know, the people in those communities, even if they weren't all the evil things that the media cast them as and the right wing cast them as, I think I still believed that they were still somewhat, you know, helpless or you know, needed to be helped, but somewhat paternalistic, you know, in the way that I would have viewed them. And it was getting to know folks and realizing, my God, these are people who actually understand the political system a lot better than I do, and I've got a college degree. You know, these are people that have a lot more understanding of the economic system than I do, and I studied all those things. So it just really sort of flipped my world upside down and congealed at a very particular time when these things stopped being academic for me, you know, and started being quite a bit more personal.
Well, I'm hoping very much that there are more, you know, people in the United States of any background, culture, or so-called race that can go from that academic head right straight to the heart of it, heart of the matter. So I'm just delighted to hear that because I don't really hear that a whole lot, sure, quite frankly, sure. Tim. So that's when it got personal for you.
Well, you know, that was part of it. I mean, at the same time that was going on, actually a little bit before that, it was all sort of over the course of 4 or 5 years. But I graduated from college in 1990, and you know, in Louisiana at that time, as some of the listeners will certainly remember, David Duke, who's a, you know, white supremacist, former Klan leader, largest. Probably most prominent white supremacist in the U.S. for the last 50 years, was running for the United States Senate. He'd already won a seat in the state legislature, and he was running for U.S. Senate at the time. And two men who were, you know, friends of mine and colleagues of mine at Tulane, where I went to school, started along with others an organization to, you know, sort of lead the charge against Duke. And I was hired right out of college to be involved in that work. Did that work for 2 years, both during the Senate race and then after Duke was defeated in that race, he ran for governor. So I was involved in the anti-Duke coalition for the governor's race as well. And that was another thing that really, I think, for me made it personal, because at the end of the day, you know, even though we were able with the help of, you know, 88% turnout in the black community, which really was what made the difference in defeating Duke, nonetheless, even though we were able to defeat him because of that turnout, he did manage to get, and I think a lot of people forget this or maybe never knew it, in 1990 in the Senate race, he got 60% of the white vote, 6 out of 10 white voters. In the governor's race in 91, he got 55% of the white vote, 55 out of 100 white voters. So what this meant to me, and I can recall very clearly, you know, at the age of 23 or so when this election, governor's race election was over in 91, sort of sitting around and thinking about what it meant that, you know, roughly 6 out of 10 people who check off the census boxes the same way I do, who are white, like I am, voted for a guy who they knew was a Nazi. And, you know, it's not as if they didn't know. There's no way you couldn't have known. Everybody in the United States knew. I mean, this was a national, it was an international story. Everyone in Louisiana knew what this guy was and what he believed in. And yet 6 out of 10 white people basically said at the end of the day, oh, well, you know, yeah, he's a Nazi, but gee, I prefer him to the other guy. And I just remember thinking, what does it say? You know, I knew that 6 out of 10 white people in that state were not themselves Nazis. You know, I knew that they weren't. I knew that they weren't 6 out of 10 hateful, bigoted Klansmen or something, but they were willing to vote for a guy who was all of that. And to me, you know, I had to really reflect on what separated me from them. I wasn't any better than them in a sense of being more moral or necessarily, you know, more wonderful human being. The only difference that I could really come up with was, you know, I'd had a certain set of experiences growing up. I'd been raised one particular way and had certain views, and they had been raised a very different way and they'd had different experiences, but they weren't to blame for their upbringing and their experiences. And I didn't really deserve any credit for mine. You know, I was just fortunate, and they weren't, to have parents who, you know, led me away from Nazis. Nazism, I guess, and led me away from white supremacist thinking, and I couldn't be smug about that. I mean, that was that moment where I realized that there was sort of this this sickness that was permeating, quote unquote, my people, and it wasn't because they were bad people. You know, most of them were good, but good people were capable of doing some really fundamentally horrific things, like voting for someone like David Duke. You know.
Well, I'll tell you, we're up to our first break. We will be right back with Tim Wise in just a few minutes.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Many people are seeking to make a difference in the world, but few actually have the tools to do so. Every week, host Mary Beth Lodge and her guests will have you thinking forward and will give you the tips to keep your life, goals, priorities, and choices on track. The result is an easier, happier, and more inspired life. The name of the program is What Matters. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. What really matters is the positive changes that you'll bring to your life and the world just by listening. What does the new healthcare law mean to you? Why is the country facing a deepening deficit? Can it be reversed? If education is important to fund, shouldn't we insist on seeing results? Do we have a workable energy policy? Who's calling the shots? Tune in to In the Public Interest with host Mike Hudson. We'll cover public policy, everything from taxes and spending to health care and other threatened entitlements. If it's in the public interest, it's in your interest to know. In the Public Interest can be heard live every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Well, I'm delighted that we're back with Tim Wise, who has joined us today, and we just got through talking about what made it personal for Tim to continue this work. Well, you know, Tim, I wanted to get back to part of our discussion today on the new demonizing trend, and you outlined a lot of that before we went to break as well. But one of the points that comes up has to do with white imagination, as you call it, white identity and imagination. Can you talk a little bit about that for a moment?
Well, in what context?
In the context of this new demonizing, or people who are in a new economic circumstance who are white or European Americans.
Well, you know, I'll try to put it in some historical perspective. The funny thing, and again, I'm using funny in quotes a little bit here because it's not all that humorous, but the funny thing about this resurgence of sort of anti-government, anti-public service, anti-social safety net program mentality is that it's really quite new for white Americans. You know, we forget that 60, 70 years ago, during the Great Depression and shortly thereafter, there was really widespread support among virtually all folks in this country, except for the very wealthy. For large government intervention in the economy, in the housing markets with the FHA and the VA loan programs, which really created the middle class, in the job market, in the schools with the GI Bill and enhanced public education and loans for college. There was just a widespread agreement among the so-called working class or what we might now call the middle or lower middle class that sometimes, you know, the market just didn't work and that the state was needed to intervene. Now, rich people didn't feel that way because they, you know, they wanted people to have to work for them at whatever lousy wage they were willing to pay. So the ultra wealthy felt then pretty much, I guess, the way many of them do now. But everyone else, realized that there was a role to play for government intervention. The Republican Party platform of 1956 actually was militantly pro-union. It talked about the importance of the state, you know, and so we see how much has changed. What changed, and what I think Americans need to get their head around this, particularly in a political season like the one we're in now, is, you know, why did we all of a sudden turn against those things? And you can actually trace the history of that. I mean, there are sociologists, Martin Gillens and Jill Credagno and others who have looked at the way that the discussions about anti-poverty efforts, about government intervention in the housing markets and the job markets, all of a sudden switched from generally being positive toward being a negative view of those things. And it begins really in the late 1960s, the early 1970s. Now, what happens between, let's say, the 30s and 40s on the one hand and the 60s and 70s on the other? Well, what happens is that all of a sudden, you know, people of color who had been blocked from almost all of those government programs in the earliest days. They had been blocked from the FHA and the VA loans. They had been highly limited in their ability to use the GI Bill. People of color had been blocked from the AFDC, or what then was called the ADC program, the Maine Cash Welfare Program. They had been blocked from food stamps in many states. All of a sudden, when people of color fought and gained access to the programs that white folks had always had access to, then all of a sudden we turned against the notion of government support for those in need. And for the last 40 years, there's been that constant repetition of that symbolism that somehow when we talk about helping the have-nots or the have-lessers, the assumption in the white imagination, and frankly, even in the imaginations of some folks of color, is that we're talking about taking from white people and giving to people of color. When in fact, of course, millions of white folks have always depended upon those programs in times of need. And right now, when the job market is in the situation it is, when the housing market is where it's been for several years, needing those very programs. So the scapegoating of people of color and those programs and the association of those efforts with people of color has helped to reduce support for them. And in fact, there's been some interesting international studies which have found that the primary thing, the number one factor differentiating the United States from the other Western industrialized nations that we like to compare ourselves to, the number one thing differentiating us in terms of why we don't have, let's say, for instance, guaranteed health care, guaranteed national health care, and those other nations by and large do, the biggest single factor in those studies is the belief on the part of white folks that if we have bigger programs like that, black and brown folks will abuse them. So in other words, the irony is that white folks are so obsessed with the notion that people of color are going to get something over on us, going to get something for nothing, that we're actually willing to cut programs or never even implement programs that we could benefit from just to keep other people from quote unquote taking advantage of them. It's really somewhat psychotic, and it's leading to, you know, a safety net that is just utterly Swiss cheese like, you know, in its orientation.
Well, you know, that brings up so many points, one of which kind of leads us to, well, where is the blame finger now being pointed? Is it going someplace else as well, or is it still stuck with people of color?
Well, it's still, I think, very much stuck with people of color. And, of course, with a black president, it's very easy symbolically for commentators who wish to scapegoat the poor and the working class to especially, you know, push those buttons of racial resentment, because they can, without even really even saying it, they can just suggest that somehow, you know, this president, especially because he's a person of color, is going to bend over backwards for those people. In fact, there's a new video that apparently just surfaced today of Mitt Romney at a fundraiser a few years back, or I guess not a few months ago, talking to donors behind closed doors, saying that 47% of Americans will vote for the president no matter what because they're dependent on government. They believe they're victims, that government has the responsibility to care for them, and they believe they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing. Now, he doesn't say that these people are black, and of course they wouldn't all be black. They wouldn't all be people of color. That'd be an awful lot of white folks, too. We talk about 47% of the population. But that whole notion that 47% of the population are quote-unquote dependent on government, aside from being absurd, it isn't true. That's ridiculous. I mean, we're talking that includes people who, you know, are dependent only in the sense that they might get they might be elderly and get Medicare benefits. They might be elderly and get Medicaid Part D prescription drug benefits. They might get the earned income tax credit, God forbid, which, you know, is a program that even Ronald Reagan used to support. They might get the deductible refundable child care tax credit. They might use, you know, the Head Start START program. I mean, those are not things that most people, or they might get Pell Grants, 8 million college students that get Pell Grants. That's not being dependent on government. It's taking advantage of programs that you've paid for vis-a-vis tax dollars. So it's an ignorant statement, number one, but it's also sort of racially coded in the sense that we know that when we talk about people who are quote-unquote dependent on government, study after study after study has told us for years what people imagine when they hear that phrase, right? In other words, you say welfare dependent, so you say dependent on the state, and what people see, whether or not you intend it, what people tend to see is a person of color. And so to the extent that that's the association, and I, you know, there are at least six or seven studies that have found that, and I've referenced them on my website and recent articles. If that's what people are hearing, it's fundamentally irresponsible for folks to use that kind of phraseology, because they have to know that that's what people are seeing, that that's what people are hearing. And so it becomes this sort of dog whistle way in which people can speak about race and speak about racial others without ever having to actually call it out. And occasionally they slip, okay? Occasionally they will slip, as a Fox News host, Greg Gutfeld, who's on a couple of Fox programs a couple of weeks ago during the Republican convention, he actually made this argument. He's a white guy. He was talking about Mia Love, the black Mormon candidate for Congress in one of the districts out in Utah, and he was talking about her and contrasting her with black folks generally, and he was saying, you know, how great she was because she can be the one to remind people, you know, that the Democratic Party is basically, you know, made an entire race dependent on government. And he's obviously talking about black people. I mean, that's, you know, the only context of his conversation was about African Americans. So he makes that comment as if somehow, you know, black people are all dependent on government. Not only is that incredibly racist in the sense that it denigrates an entire group of people for supposedly, you know, being dependent and lazy and slothful, which is the perception, but it's also wrong. I mean, I actually went back, looked at the numbers, and the fact is, contrary to popular belief, if you were to take all the adults in this country who are black, who actually receive any cash welfare benefits at all, we're talking just adults now, you would be looking at less than 400,000 African-American adults in the entire United States who receive cash welfare in the course of a given year. Less than 400,000 people in a nation where there are 29 million African-American adults in all. So we're talking about an infinitesimally small percentage of the population, but when folks use that kind of phraseology, they know full well that it gins up racial anxiety, racial resentment, makes white people angry, makes white people think they're getting taken advantage of. And it has nothing to do with the truth. It has everything to do with pushing those buttons of anger, resentment, and even racial hostility.
Well, this is some old encoding that seems to not go away.
Right.
You know, we've heard this kind of thing for years. And part of what we like to do with the healing of racism really is call it what it is, and to, as you say, too, unpack it in a way that people will understand. But, you know, I'm kind of stuck, though, a bit with this part of the imagination, because obviously what you looked up, and you do your homework, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You looked up the data, but the messages in the larger society don't seem to change.
Right. Right. Well, that's just it. I mean, and there's a lot of research on this too, which unfortunately is very demoralizing for those of us who think that facts ought to matter. You know, what the research actually finds is that sadly, when it comes to issues that are highly emotionally charged, and God knows, you know, racial issues are, gender issues are, class issues are, religious issues are, that those are issues where the facts mean absolutely nothing to swaying people. People are sort of dug in to what they believe to be true. And in fact, some research has found that when you present the facts, the hard, true evidence to someone who's really committed to believing the opposite of what the truth is, they actually dig in harder. You know, they actually are, not only do they not get persuaded, they actually will become more resolute, ever more convinced that they are right and that you are wrong. And so this poses a real challenge. And I don't think any of us have quite figured out, you know, how to deal with that. How do you deal with people who are impervious to facts? How do you deal with people who actually want to believe something that, you know, whether it's science or whether it's social science, says says is not true or says is true and they refuse to believe that it's true, what do you do? And I'd love to tell you I have the answer to that. I don't really know. but I think that's the challenge because, you know, people can lie about poor folks. They can lie about people of color. They can lie about immigrants. They can lie about all kinds of things. And there are large numbers of the American population who apparently are wired to believe the lie. And so we're going to have to figure out some cognitive strategy, some rhetorical strategy, some type of organizing strategy to break that down, because it's certainly not a very hopeful thing to think about.
Well, we'll be right back with Tim Wise and talking about demonizing, maybe a new trend. We'll be back shortly.
Talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as host Jordan Kimmel is joined by national experts in the fields of accounting, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be recognized as doing the right thing by the American Trust Awards. Your host Jordan Kimmel is himself a trusted professional with years of experience in applying strategies and consulting with today's leading firms. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to A Safe Place to Talk About Race with your host, Sharon E. Davis. We know you have something to say, so participate in today's discussion by calling 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send us an email to Sharon at safeplaceonrace.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to our show. Our guest is Tim Wise, who is an anti-racist author and educator, and we've covered a lot of territory, and there's so much more to cover, Tim.
Sure.
My goodness. But maybe we could pick up a little bit where we left off in parts of this demonizing trend. And, you know, what do the new, group of whites or European Americans think now when they're thrown in, lumped into a category of receiving services and human services from the government? Where is that finger pointing now?
Well,
what do they think?
You know, this is sort of the challenge. I mean, the problem is that when you've had four decades of demonization of any type of programs for the have-nots or have-lessers, what ends up happening is that when you need those programs, you have to deal with the fact that in many ways, the vast majority of white folks, including a lot of those white folks who find themselves in need of those things now, you've got to deal with the fact that you've come to think over the years, that anybody who needs those things is personally to blame, you know, that they're lazy,
right,
that they made bad choices. And, you know, how does
right.
the, how does the human mind deal with that, that sense of self-blame? I mean, this is the horrific irony of right-wing political and social and economic ideology is, you know, as long as it's working for you, it's working for you. But the minute
right.
that it doesn't work for you anymore, all you're left with is either self-blame, because that's what you've come to believe. You've said all along, get a job, get a job. If you don't have a job, get a job. And now all of a sudden, you can't find a job. And it can be psychologically very distressing. When one is psychologically distressed, one either has to blame oneself, but there's sort of a built-in, you know, defense mechanism not to let that happen. Or you can blame the system and start to realize, wow, maybe the system isn't what I thought it was. But that's tough, because everything you've been taught your whole life is that, you know, everybody can do it if they just try hard. And if you believe that and you don't understand the systemic barriers to making that true, then, you know, it's hard to come to that conclusion. The only other option, and it's the one that I think we're seeing used more and more by some of these white folks who are struggling right now, is to blame, you know, sort of project outward, to deflect the blame, to project it onto others. So, and we'll project it onto immigrants. Well, if we could just close the border, you know, our taxes mm-hmm. would go down and we would have a job. Or if we can just get rid of affirmative action, if we can just get rid of this program or that program, then all of a sudden everything will be better. And I think that's what, unfortunately, a lot of white Americans are falling into, is it actually, instead of making them rethink scapegoating, it's making them go further towards it. But I do think it provides us an opening to have that honest conversation about the system, because, you know, bottom line, you can blame immigrants, you can blame welfare, you can blame affirmative action, you can do all that, but at some point you have to come clean with the facts and the reality that this is an economic system that was never intended to benefit the vast majority of people in this country, including the vast majority of white folks. We just had the luxury for generations of thinking that this system was set up for us, and while we certainly had it better than people of color, to the top 1%, the top 0.5%, 1/10, 1/100, they really couldn't care less about the fundamental well-being of the vast majority of the rest of us, and they think that when we, you know, don't have the ability to pay our mortgage because we got roped into a predatory loan, that we're the ones to blame. That's why when Rick Santelli at CNBC started the so-called rant heard round the world that launched the Tea Party back in 2009, he was talking about homeowners who were belly up on their loans, and he called them losers, and he said, you know, nobody wants to bail out these losers. Well, a lot of these quote-unquote losers were, you know, really hard-working middle-class families who'd gotten lied to by banks, who'd been lied to by lenders, they'd been lied to by independent mortgage brokers who got them into loans saying, oh, don't worry, you know, the interest rate, yeah, and 3 years, it's going to go up, but don't worry, we'll renegotiate it. And then, of course, they didn't. And the lenders were making money hand over fist. They were deceiving the borrowers. And then when the borrowers lost their shirt, you know, these folks that speak for the top 0.5% or the top 0.1% sort of laughed at the rest of us. That's what this is about. And the quicker that millions of working class white folks figure that out, that they're being gamed by the same system that for years was gaming black and brown folks, the better off we're going to be.
Well, thank you for that summary, because it just sounds spot on. And before we get too much further into this topic, you know, from the perspective of racial healing, we're all members of the same human family species, is what we like to say a lot of times, to make that distinction. And it isn't just solely whites or European Americans. There are people of color who actually believe this lie this distortion of reality as well.
Sure, sure. Well, and of course, you know, people of color who believe it will be propelled to the forefront of the conservative movement, because that's a movement that desperately needs black and brown faces to give, you know, cover to their own ideology, you know. So if you go to a Tea Party rally and there are some black people around, you can bet they're going to be on camera. And you can mm-hmm. bet not only are they going to be on camera, they're going to be on stage. You know, they're going to be front and center, very prominent, because it allows the right to pass itself off as somehow other than what it is, which is a party that for 40 years has deliberately sought to push buttons of racial resentment. And what's funny is, you know, every now and then they'll admit it. I mean, Lee Atwater, who was, you know, one of the most prominent Republican consultants and campaign managers in this country's history, when he, you know, he managed the 88 campaign for George H.W. Bush and you know, worked with Reagan and others. And when he was dying, he ended up dying of cancer in the early 90s or mid-90s, but when he died, you know, he, before he died, he was talking about what he was doing, and he said, you know, this is what we did, and he was ashamed of it. He had his little, you know, sort of come to Jesus moment where he said, you know, we realized starting in the 70s that you couldn't just yell the N-word anymore, so we had to say it other ways. We talked about welfare, and we talked about taxes, and we talked about busing, and, you know, he admitted that that is what he was doing, and the fact that an awful lot of white folks fell for it and that some people of color did is undeniable.
Well, you know, I'm familiar with that story also, but I wonder how many of our listening audience members out there even know about that story, because I don't think that it got a whole huge profile for a long period of time in any kind of healing way, Tim.
Right, right. Well, it didn't, and folks who are interested in that, it's really a very telling story. I mean, Atwater was a very interesting figure, very polarizing figure, but he did, you know, have this sort of realization late in life, and you know, whatever, whether it was a deathbed confession or whatever it was, I mean, he had come to the conclusion that he had helped to contribute to some really fundamentally politically evil things, and you know, there's a documentary about him actually called Boogeyman that you know, is, people should check it out. I mean, it's quite well done. But you know, I think that, and I don't want to imply by anything that I'm saying there that all, you know, Republicans or that all conservatives are motivated by racism. That's certainly not what I'm saying. But I am saying that it's very hard to understand modern conservative politics, and I just mean the last 40 years or so, without understanding the centrality of race to our politics as a country. You know, it was possible to be a conservative without race being central, certainly. You know, even if everyone in the United States was the same race, we'd still have conservative people who believed in limited government or whatever, you know. But the thing is, this country in the last 40 to 50 years, that debate has been inherently connected to a debate over race and a debate over the racial distribution of stuff. And so it's impossible to sort of separate it. You know, nobody who's in their 40s like I am or older can say that they have come up in an era where conservatism existed separate from a racial dynamic. It just isn't true. And so, you know, it's not that all Republicans or that all conservatives are racist, and it's not that all liberals and Democrats aren't, you know, because there was a survey taken right before the 08 election, which found that a large number of white voters for Obama still believed, according to their own admission, to a whole host of negative stereotypes about black people. They were just making an exception for this one black guy. So not all Republicans are racist, and there are plenty of Democrats who I'm sure are, but that's what we've got to contend with, is the way that all of our perceptions have been shaped by this racial framing for the last 4 and 5 decades.
Well, you know, this might get us into a question from one of our Arden listeners, Marie in Missouri. And her question is there a large-scale way to teach white people that this is a nation of institutionalized racism and that we don't, and we really don't have a level playing field? What do you think, Tim?
Well, I mean, there's no silver bullet way to do it, obviously. I mean, it's one of the things that my work is principally focused on, trying to make that case to white folks and get white folks to think about what that means, both for understanding where we are now and also figuring out where we need to go as a country. So no, I mean, there's certainly no silver bullet. If there were, I wouldn't have to keep doing it, and other millions, other thousands of us who do this work, white folks and people of color, we could all take a break and not have to do it. But right. I do think, look, I think that if we have the conversation where we talk about our own experiences connected to institutions, that's the best chance that we have. I think sometimes we try to make this argument. We make it in an overly academic, intellectual way. And like I said before, the sad thing is research says numbers don't matter, facts don't matter, right? People who are really bought into a particular worldview dig in harder when you give them facts that contradict their worldview. But what's interesting in my experience is that if I tell stories that demonstrate institutional racism, and maybe only after telling the story link it to some data or research, that it has a much bigger impact. It's why my first book, White Like Me, was a memoir rather than, you know, a fact-based, you know, heavily footnoted volume, because I felt like if I told stories about my own life demonstrating my own experiences with white racial privilege and institutional racism, that it would make those numbers that you might see in an academic article or a book more real to people. And over the course of the years since that book was first published, which was in late 04, early 05, that has been my experience. That there are people who say, look, I've read lots of books on race, but until I, you know, heard these personal stories, it didn't connect for me. And so, you know, people will sometimes write to me and thank me for one of the other books that has a lot of footnotes, and they'll say things like, "Ah, I really like that book. It helped me with my, you know, my research paper, or it helped me with my dissertation." And I'm always, you know, I'll say, "Thanks. Well, I'm glad it helped you." But people will call or write or whatever and say about White Like Me that it really changed their view of thinking about race. So I think if we can use our own experience and say, "Hey, it's not just that I'm telling you institutional racism is real. Here's how I know, because I've seen it in action, and here's my personal story." Yes, people can still dismiss it, but basic common decency and courtesy leads most people to be less demonstrative when they're responding to your personal narrative than if you're just giving them numbers, right? Because if you tell them about a study, they can dismiss it without seeming to attack you. But if I tell them, "Well, this is what I saw in public housing, and this is what I saw in the school systems that I attended, and this is what I see now with my own kids," people might not agree with you, but they're more inclined to at least listen, because it's personal and they don't want to personally attack you. And so I think maybe that as a strategy, starting with the personal and then moving into that institutional as sort of a 1-2 punch kind of thing, probably is the best approach.
Well, it certainly is effective, and, you know, we always have thought that racial healing is within the stories, and, of
right.
course, the data is undeniable,
right.
but
right.
the stories. Well, along these lines also, Tim, some people think that racial healing, even the phrasing of it, is just really soft,
right.
really soft,
right.
and that this isn't a surprise to you. You know, there seem to be a number of people who consider you a lightning rod and actually, I think, fear you in a way.
Right. Well,
can you talk about that and talk about racial healing and this
well,
fear?
Well, you know, I don't know, you know, if people are particularly afraid of me. That'd be sort of silly. I'm you know, 5'9" on a good day and not particularly rough, you know. But, yeah, I think people are afraid of hearing truth spoken in an unvarnished way. And the reason is, it's not just me. I mean, there are lots of truth tellers out there on these issues, most of whom, of course, are people of color.
Right.
I think that what people are afraid of is just hearing unvarnished truth, because for so long, we have played games. I mean, our politicians play games. Everything is about, you know, how can I say this in a way that's going to be best for the polls? You know, how can I say this in a way that is going to be, you know, politically acceptable to people and not get me in trouble with a particular constituency? And, you know, I'm lucky to be, you know, an activist and a writer who doesn't really have to think about that a lot. And it also helps to be a white male who has the luxury of frankly mouthing off about racism and being viewed far differently than a person of color who speaks in the same way. I mean, you can listen to my talks online and read my articles and books, and I speak with a forcefulness that is easier for me. It's not because I'm a better speaker or a better writer. It's because being a white male, my threshold of acceptable anger is a lot higher. You know, I'm given a pass that people of color are not, and I want to point that out because I you know, people of color know that's true, and I want white folks to know that's true. It's not that I'm more passionate. It's not that I'm, God knows, I'm not angrier than people of color about white supremacy and racism, but I have the luxury of coming across a bit angrier, perhaps, and still getting away with it, and I'm going to use that privilege if I have it, because if it helps, then it's worth deploying. But as I deploy it, I want to make sure people understand, right, that folks of color, unfortunately, are not given the same benefit of the doubt when they are angry. In fact, if a person of color expresses anger about racism, they're seen as threatening and in ways that I've never, ever seen. As far as the notion of racial healing, you know, I've gone all around the block on this, and I'm still not settled on how I feel about the phraseology. Sometimes I feel like it sounds weak, but then there are other times I realize, you know, this thing has done stuff to us, and it has done very personal stuff to us, and it has damaged us beyond belief, white and of color. And so healing is part of it. I don't ever want to overdraw the illness or the sickness analogies that bring up a word like healing. But at the same time, I don't want to dismiss them, because what I've learned is that we cannot stay in our heads the whole time about this topic. It can't just be about numbers and statistics and data. I have, you know, memorized reams of data. I know virtually every study that's been done on these subjects, and I will talk about those in those moments when I think it's appropriate, when it might be helpful. But if we can't talk also about what this thing does to us, what it does to our children, what it does to the future of the country from a much more affective, emotional, and personal personal place, then, you know, no one is going to go to the barricades, so to speak, to change the system just because they read a good study. You know, nobody is going to go to the barricades to change this system just because they read a position paper from some nonprofit organization and they see that the data actually says, oh my gosh, everything I've always thought was wrong. You know, that's not what leads people to change societies. What leads them to change societies is a deep and abiding sense that if they do not make a shift and do not make a transition, that they themselves and their children, the future of their society is going to be in jeopardy. So if healing sounds weak to people, let's keep in mind that very little institutional transformation is going to come about from broken people. You know, it's very hard for people that are broken and damaged to lead a quote-unquote revolution of any type. And so we do have to work on ourselves even as we're working on changing the structures of the society.
Well, you know, this brings us to a couple of other questions that have come in. One is from Ron in Dallas. And one of his questions is, why is the concept white privilege so difficult for the average white person to understand and acknowledge? You may have already answered parts of this, Tim.
Well, I think that's really actually, that one's pretty simple. I think the reason it's hard is that we have a very skewed understanding of what privilege means. You know, if you ask most people what does it mean to be privileged, they are thinking that it means born with a silver spoon in your mouth, having a lot of money. And so if you're white and you don't have a lot of money, which most white folks are not wealthy, most white folks are you know, decidedly middle class and working class just like everyone else, it's real easy then for a white person to say, well, what do you mean? I'm not privileged. I don't have money. I wasn't born with money. I didn't inherit wealth. But what we need to remember is privilege is not just about money. That's part of it. There's a material part of it for sure. And it is true that on balance, white folks have generally had far better material position than people of color. But when I talk about white privilege, I'm very deliberate about not focusing on the money part of it until after we deal with the first part, which is the psychological part, right? It's the part that I try to explain. It's that ability of those of us who are white to go through our day not having to really think about our racial identity as a possible marker of negativity in a given day. If we're applying for a job, going shopping, driving through a neighborhood, whatever it is, we're not worried that our race is going to mark us negatively in the eyes of others, in the eyes of authority figures. And so it's that ability to have one less thing to have to think about today. And, you know, in a competitive society, having one less thing to worry about is a big deal, and it has material consequence. And I try to analogize it, and I find this to be pretty effective. I analogize it to able-bodied people, right? Obviously, if you're disabled, you face discrimination. You face obstacles, barriers on the basis of your identity as a person with a disability. We all know that. Those of us who are able-bodied know that we can go through the day not really having to think about how I'm going to get in a building, out of a building, if there's a fire at work, how do I get out? You know, those are the things that able-bodied people don't think about. People with disabilities who face obstacles on the basis of that identity think about that stuff regularly. Now, that doesn't mean that for those of us who are able-bodied that our lives are easy. I mean, you know, lots of able-bodied people are poor. Lots of able-bodied people are struggling. But I don't think anybody would deny that it does mean that on balance, to be able-bodied gives you a certain leg up, so to speak. It does give you a certain advantage, a certain privilege psychologically and maybe even materially over people who are disabled. The fact that there are some disabled people who are rich and some able-bodied people who are poor would never lead someone to say, well, see, that just proves there's no able-bodied privilege because I know a guy who is in a wheelchair, but he's got $1 million in the bank. I mean, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. You know, it doesn't take away from the fact of able-bodied privilege. And the same is true here. Are there white folks who are struggling? Yes. But all it means is that on balance, to be white in a society where whiteness has been a marker of domination is to give you a leg up, so to speak. It doesn't mean that white folks will win every competition against people of color, that they'll get every job. But it does mean that on balance, to be white, just like being male, just like being rich, just like being able-bodied, et cetera, gives you a certain advantage, and it can't be ignored.
Well, you know, I tell you, we could talk a lot more about that particular subject as well, but we do have a second question from Ron from Dallas that takes us in a slightly different direction. Sure. And his question is, Jewish people have been successful at making some countries and their citizens, including the United States, take ownership for allowing the Holocaust to happen. Why is it that white America feels no such obligation when it comes to slavery and its after effects?
Well, I mean, I think that in part there's a lot that goes into the answer to that. I think part of it is that in the last 50 years in this country, those of us who are Jewish, and I am Jewish religiously in terms of my family heritage, Jewish folks have been able to, quote-unquote, become white in a way, right? There was certainly a time when Jewish folks were not considered part of the white race, just like Irish folks weren't, Italian folks weren't. But in the last half of the 20th century, that really started to change. And so now white folks are seen, for reasons that are complicated, as being, you know, just another type of white person. And so whenever a group that is now considered white presses a claim for justice, it's a lot easier for other white folks to listen to than it is when a person of color does. So it's also easier in the case of Jewish folks, because if you think about what, you know, Jewish folks who have received some sympathy for the European Holocaust, or even in the case of from Germany getting recompense for that, you know, that happens somewhere else. And so in the United States, it's no sweat off our back to acknowledge it. It's no sweat off our back to talk about, you know, what Germany did. In fact, it's interesting. Several years ago, and there was a adult education program for people getting their GED here in Tennessee, where I live, and I made the news. And it was a program on tolerance. They were teaching these adult ed students, and the curriculum was entirely about the Holocaust of European Jewry. And I thought, well, you know, I get it. I mean, I guess there are definitely some lessons to learn about tolerance from that historical experience. But it struck me as very odd that they would make that the subject when, you know, I live and the department where this was created in downtown Nashville is about 20 minutes drive, maybe less, from Andrew Jackson's house, right? They could have easily made a lesson about tolerance and talked about the Trail of Tears and talked about Indian removal and talked about enslavement of African peoples. But it was easier to say, look at those horrible people in that other country 60 years ago and what they did, than to look at what goes on in your own country, not only 60 years ago or 160 years ago, but, you know, 6 minutes ago. And so I think it's always easier for any country to look at the evil that others do, right? Let me put it this way. Had that happened to Jews in the United States, I'm not convinced that non-Jewish white folks in the United States would have been all that quick to take it seriously. In spite of the way that Jewish folks have quote unquote become white, I still think had it happened here, we would still be far less likely to honestly assess it. But because it happened somewhere else, we can look at it and say, oh my gosh, wasn't that terrible? Isn't that nice that we didn't do that? Even though in many ways we have done exactly that with regard to indigenous people and with regard to people of African descent.
Yes, it's very interesting how our history seems to change over a period of time. Well, Tim, this has just been more than delightful and very informative. We have less than a minute left on our show. And in this short period of time, could I ask you, do you think that our future is very bright and hopeful, or do you think that our future is fraught with a lot of contention still around this subject? About 30 seconds.
Well, I'm going to say that it's both of those things. I think we're in for some very difficult days, and I think we're in for several years of real soul-searching and very, very difficult conflict around issues of race as this country becomes a 50-50 country, 50% people of color, 50% white. I do think, however, that people have the capacity to create justice. I have to say I'm agnostic on it because I haven't seen it yet, but I believe that it's possible, and I know one thing. You know, we're only on this earth for a very short period of time. In that period, I can't think of a much better purpose to put one's life to than the purpose of creating justice. So whether it can happen or whether it can't, what are our options? You know, you either do the work or you don't. If you don't, you know you won't have justice. If you do the work, perhaps you will. And so we'll just leave it at that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights and your wisdom as well. And really glad that you're a part of our society and culture that continues to do this precious, precious work towards the oneness of humankind. Thank you, Tim, so much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you again for listening today. Please join host Sharon E. Davis for another edition of A Safe Place to Talk About Race next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk then.